Let's get started. I'll kick things off with the hell, since I'm the stranger here. I'm EC Erb. I'm from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. And we wanted to talk today some about just music programming and how that can keep your station vital and alive and sounding different from what other stations are doing in your area.
It's ringing.
Yeah, I hear that. And Gandalf and Liberty, both from our local station, WJFF, and
yeah. Thank you for coming.
Definitely a fun place. Why don't, I'm going to make you guys kick it up, actually.
Yeah.
So,
oh, boy. Well, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. It certainly is nice to be here, and it's nice to see that we had such a turnout for this thing. I gather that we are supposed to be giving you some of our own insights into music programming on the level that we do it. And since I've been handed this microphone, I guess I can start by saying this. When I started at WJFF about 4.5 years ago, I came in as a volunteer accidentally. I was told one day that I had been at the station for too many weeks in a row and that I was either going to be a volunteer or they were going to start charging me. And I became one. And then suddenly, through no fault of my own, I discovered that I had a program. Somebody who had a classical music program no longer wanted to do it and simply turned it over to me. It was about a year later that we discovered that nobody had ever given me permission to do this, that I was just doing it, and so it became my thing. Very early, and this is really my point, very early in my, during the early parts of my tenure, I decided I was going to try to play some 20th and 20th century contemporary classical music, which is an idiom that is almost lost on the American public, as far as I can tell. And lo and behold, I started getting phone calls from local listeners asking me to please play more. And my mother didn't raise anybody who was completely stupid. Even though I knew nothing whatsoever about contemporary classical music, I decided that it was going to be my hook. And for the last 4.5 years, I have played nothing on my program except 20th and 21st century classical music, with this exception. Occasionally, if I have an interview, a live guest who is a performer who doesn't play this music, I will play the music that they do play, because that falls within my purview. But the real point that I want to make here, and then I'll pass this over to Liberty, is this. By not programming contemporary classical music into your weekly schedule, you give up a gold mine of interviews. I was making a list of some of the people that I've interviewed in the last few years. I've interviewed over 100 people in the last few years, composers and performers. Steve Mayer, Robert Mano, Lou Spratlin, who was a Pulitzer Prize winner, David Del Tredici, who was a Pulitzer Prize winner, Frank Retzel, who composed the music that was played when the Pope gave his in 1995 in Shea Stadium. Terry Riley, I don't know if that name means anything to you, but I aired an interview with Terry Riley last week. He's one of the fathers of minimalism. Stephen Mikus, who is a German composer who lives in the Canary Islands, set up by the company that produces his CDs. They pay for the telephone call. I didn't have to pay a cent. Roberto Sierra, who is a professor at Cornell. Carol Husa, another Pulitzer Prize winner, who et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Peter Martins, that's how that started off. I got a phone call from the New York City Ballet Company asking me if I would interview Peter Martins. My point is that without belaboring this, if your station does not have a 20th century classical music program, it's missing out on a gold mine as far as I'm concerned. These are people who are desperate to get heard. They will give you interviews. You're more likely to be able to get free CDs from them if you have a program like this. And
do you think that's countrywide?
I'll tell you something. I have searched to see how many radio stations have a classical, 20th century classical, 21st century classical program. Almost none. There's one in...
But I mean, if I did it in Fort Collins, Colorado, would I have the kind of response?
Why not?
Being nearer the cultural center of the world.
I promise you that if you call these... If you call these people, if you get in touch with these people and you ask them if they will interview you, if you can, you may have to pay for the telephone call. I mean, when I interviewed Terry Riley the other day in California, and it was a 45 or 48 minute interview, and the station picks up the tab on that. You know, that's part of the deal. But yeah, you'll get them. Try it. See what happens. These people are so anxious to be heard, and they're so wonderful. You know, the complaint about 20th century music is that you can't listen to it. Well, you can't listen to it if you don't listen to it. When you start listening to it, it becomes something that's really worthwhile. So the first part of my pitch is, in your programming, think about doing some 20th century classic, 21st century classical music, some contemporary classical music. I didn't know anything about it. I still don't know anything about it, but I work at it. All right, now it's Liberty's turn. You've got to. Thank you for holding my coffee, dear. You're so sweet.
My name is Liberty Green, and if I could figure this out, I have a show on Thursday nights called Soul Spectrum. It's slated to go from 10 to midnight, but I usually end up staying on closer to 1 o'clock. And I play what I call soul music. I called it Soul Spectrum so I could have some leeway. And mostly I'm interested in, you know, the 70s was my era, but I love the 60s. Sometimes I play some 50s music, and sometimes I play some 80s, even 90s music. But the thing that, and basically also what I do is I don't necessarily play, I don't want to be playing A-sides. I try to dig deeper and go and play the album cuts and things that people, you know, wouldn't have heard on the radio. And right the very first week I was on the air, something happened. I got a letter from a gentleman from a correctional facility, and it was a 5-page letter, and until the second half of the fourth page, I wasn't actually sure if the fellow liked the show or not, because he ranted and raved about, you know, well, social issues, let's just say. And here I am, you know, well, anyway, after that, that was the very first week, and it's never stopped. And I receive a tremendous amount of mail from incarcerated men. Evidently, there's quite a few facilities within our listening area. And some of the, you know, this was so totally unforeseen for me, and basically, it's fallen in my lap, and I run with it. So I get the most incredible, heartfelt letters every week. I get poetry, I get artwork, I get all kinds of things. So, you know, I wasn't going to write them back, but I felt obligated to respond. So now we play music from 10 to 11, and at 11 o'clock, I do the mail, and I answer these guys on the air, and it's been, I've only been on the air since October, but I have hundreds of letters now, and they ask my advice. Some of them rap to me, but they talk about the music, a lot of them. They request stuff that they can't hear any other way. And, you know, I have the proverbial captive audience, and it's really wonderful, because they really are there every week, and they review me. You know, my show's on Thursday nights, so Monday the letters start coming in, and I get my reviews every week, and they're usually good. But the other thing that's happened is this one guy, in an effort to impress me, wrote me a story one week, and it was a 10-page story, and what he did was he included song titles throughout the story. And I was skeptical, because he told me it was coming, but when I read it, it was really good. And so I decided to read it on the air, and I divided it up into 3 weeks, and he agreed to continue the story. So now we're in our fourth month of it. It's called Silly Love Songs, and he includes the song titles throughout, and this has also proven to be somewhat problematic, because it started out as a love story, and then it got incredibly violent the last 2 weeks. Right? You know, I sort of am coming to know the guy that's writing the story. I've never met him. We communicate through the mail only. But so I had to sort of, you know, get on the air and say, look, I want you to reel it back in and you know, go back to songs, you know, more of love and music. And so I haven't heard from him yet. So I'm waiting to see how it plays out. But, you know, this is all part of the challenge. So, and then after 11 o'clock, after I do the mail and the silly love songs, we've fallen into this thing called blue lights in the basement. If anybody knows what that basically stood for, it was, I think, a term used in the 60s. And it was basically parties. People had parties in their basements, and you'd turn on the blue light, and you'd play slow music, and that's how you got close to your girl. And so I sort of one night said something to the effect of, we're going to do some blue light specials, and it's evolved into this whole thing of love songs, and the guys absolutely love it, and they write me, and they play, you know, play on words about, you know, when are you going to come out of the basement, or when are we going to go into the basement, and all kinds of stuff like that. But so here I am, 9 months down the road, and this is what sort of been put in my path, and I've I enjoy it. I really have a lot of fun. So that's me.
When I walked into KGNU, my interest at the time had been kind of heavy into the punk scene, which will kind of date me, obviously. And for me, I realized, okay, this wasn't maybe something that was going to fly. And what I did was discover the world of international music. So, like Gandalf was saying, at the time I hadn't known a lot about that, and I thought, you know, there's a lot happening here, and was really able to get into a lot of music, see that we had a lot of CDs. KGNU was fortunate to already, well, at that time they were on vinyl, we had a nice collection, and start building on that. And what's wonderful is in our community, KGNU is now known to be very supportive of the whole international music scene. That, you know, we're not like the Johnny Come Lately on something like this. It's an acknowledgement, hey, we have played this kind of programming for a very long time, so that we're able to offer our community a show dedicated only to African music, one show dedicated solely to Latin music, and two more international-based shows, one of which is normally more traditional, and the other one has been just a field day, because we come out after our rap show, so what do? But play some of the really funky, you know, world rap, world techno, and just a great variety of beats. To me, this, you know, these kind of experiences like we're talking about are what's really key, is here are programmers who have come into our stations who are saying, I'm intrigued by this, and the stations are able to give people the opportunity to say, I want to learn more about this. And I always feel like that is crucial. When I have new programmers coming in through the door, obviously it's great when people have an expertise and a knowledge in a certain kind of music, but when I can push people and see people learning more about the music and sharing that with the listeners, I think that's absolutely key. We should really be trying to do our programming not just where we're grandstanding and saying, well, I know this, so that's what I'm going to play, or just not sharing much with the listeners. We want to be able to also educate people about what we're playing. As Gandalf was saying, okay, you know, we're throwing out the 20th century classical. Well, KGNU has a program in that. And I do have to field phone calls periodically with, what the heck are you doing playing that stuff? It's not music, it's, you know, and you get this variety of responses, because our 20th century classical program is very much into the avant-garde. John Cage is just an ordinary composer for a show like that, that we might be playing some of Terry Riley's longer pieces. We're not afraid within that certain forum to play that kind of music. And I think it's just a wonderful opportunity when we can put that kind of material out there, because certainly it's not what's happening on the majority of the radio in this day and age. And like KGNU, when we bring in new people, we do an orientation, and I'll talk about, look at what happens when you go up and down the radio dial, and your commercial stations are just so focused on you know, their 500 song playlist, if that. And
100.
You know, it's absurd. And digging deeper into records, finding not the hit track. I mean, it blew me away that I actually did play the new Bruce Springsteen for our audience recently. And I wasn't sure, you know, I know that within our community there are a lot of people who are going to go, what are you doing playing Bruce Springsteen on our airwaves? Well, when I looked at the record and said, look, he's got Asif Ali Khan on here, that is the kind of track that I think commercial radio is going to be kind of scared about. And our audience can be very excited that, oh, look, you know, Bruce Springsteen's finally found about these guys that, you know, we've been seeing a track record of artists from other places around the world are getting noticed. And how do they get their names out there if not stations like ours, who are willing to play music outside of the mold, outside of the different traditions that commercial radio is, to me, I think commercial radio has just boxed itself in, and I think they're losing out. The other thing I would like to mention is that the majority of programming on KGNU, our music programming, isn't really the specialty programming. We put a lot of emphasis on doing freeform programming, so that maybe we will play a soul piece and a 20th century classical piece and something from a not well-known rock group into some kind of bluegrass or, you know, slamgrass. And we're able to pull in a lot of this music that, to me anymore, is defying easy categorization, because that's where I think the innovative edge in music is today. It's not so much, you know, oh, I'm going to do this jazz standard. It's, I'm going to take jazz to a new level. You know, thankfully, groups like Medeski, Martin, and Wood are getting noticed not just from the non-commercial radio stations, but I have to say, a lot of stations don't know what to do with groups when they don't fit into the easy boxes. And yet, we have an audience that I think is really hungry to hear different sounds, different music, and especially to know a little bit about it, if you can share that with our listeners. So we have it set up in our air studio so that you can even have like internet resources there. You could pull up a band's website or AllMusic Guide and look up some of those pointers right while you're on the air. And I love having the ability to do some research right on the fly while we're on the air. Do many stations do that? You have internet access right in your studio? Good. It's good to see.
So Elaine, describe your listening audience.
That is a funny thing to try and do.
I mean,
Joanne obviously has got some familiarity with KGNU. We are in a college community. You know, Boulder, I think, is an area that's growing a little bit older, but there's always, of course, a strong 20-something crowd. And KGNU's audience, I think, is one that changes a lot through the day. We start our mornings at 9:30, our music programming comes on, and we tend to go for a more acoustic-based, diverse morning show. So we have a lot of folk country bluegrass in there. Different people will be pulling in international or jazz. Some will actually even try and go for some of the downbeat techno, you know, but more of a morning kind of vibe. And that, I think, is, you know, a slightly older audience, so that when the afternoon rolls around and we go into our afternoon sound alternative, where we have a lot more of the rock, we have a lot more of the international and ethno-techno type music, and just a lot of the newer sounds, I think that the age of the audience does come down. We tend to appeal more to the 20 and 30-somethings within that time period. From what we can tell, our listenership goes down a little bit in the evening where we do a sort of jazz-based programming, but when we say we're doing jazz, it's still, I find people able to pull folk music into that time slot. I find people you know, again, playing some of the electronic, the Saint-Germain, the kind of crossover. And I do think, again, that's a show that does tend to appeal, again, maybe to a slightly older audience. The 20 and 30-somethings are probably a little less interested in that. But then with our overnight, we really actually try and push the boundaries a lot. We try and, okay, there's music out there that's too weird for people to hear in the daytime. And that, to me, is what nighttime is for, is to get that kind of stuff out there, to make sure we are having a place on our air where some of the new punk groups and old punk groups can still be broadcast. Where, and of course, what we do is we put new DJs on at 3 o'clock in the morning, so they're cutting their teeth in that time slot. And it's very much of an anything goes type of period. And of course, you know, popular with the bakers and taxi drivers and, you know, just people that will be up late at night. So,
well, when's your 20th century classical music?
We do that on Sunday. With our programming, so Sunday mornings we have like a gospel show, 7 to 9 a.m., 9 a.m. to 11, we go to just standard classical, which actually, we have one Baroque programmer, but we do put an emphasis on, say, the 20th century, but maybe the more romantic composers. So it's at, 1 o'clock, we get to the 20th century classical. And I will say, we have referred to ghettoizing our audiences on Sunday afternoon, because it's kind of schizophrenic programming. It's programming that we think serves our mission. And, you know, do a lot of people stay at home waiting to hear modern classical music on a Sunday afternoon? Probably not.
Can you verbalize your mission in relationship to the music?
Our mission, we have words like educate, stimulate in there to appeal to, well, actually, yeah, pretty much. And we want to...
You don't say entertain?
We do say entertain. But a lot of the emphasis is music and programming not heard elsewhere in the media. And, you know, therefore, it might not have a big audience, but... You know, we are trying. Boulder has a strong Hmong community. We're working with those people, trying to get some of them involved. We're also looking at doing more Latin outreach, because the program that we do have, it's very, you know, we do have one Latino programmer involved in that group. Actually, no, two of them are. And it seems to be, let's play the fun salsa that, you know, our local white audience will be interested in. But we really like to do more to bring up the issues and the music that our local Latino community wants to hear.
Yeah. You said something earlier about the Bruce Springsteen that made me think. And it's leads into a function of what you have to do to understand the marketplace. So far, I'm not hearing Bruce Springsteen's new album played much anywhere. Because... And it's a great album, frankly, simply because the classic rock stations are so tight-assed and have their heads in the sand, will not play anything new, even if it's by a long-standing artist. The rest of the stations on the dial, commercial, won't touch it because it's not Britney Spears or NSYNC. And then after that, there are really no other options. So it's not so much that you played Bruce Springsteen because it had some international performer. He had some international performers on the lineup. You consider the fact you're playing Bruce Springsteen because, once again, it's even as famous as Bruce is and as rich as Bruce is, God bless his soul, you can't hold that against him. He's good. He's successful. We hope that for all our artists. But the point is, you can't hold that against him. But at the same rate, he's not getting played. As rich as he is, and as big as a label as he is on, he's not getting airplay. So I think in a lot of, when I talk to a lot of people between here and the PRPD, there's this mindset, well, you can't touch somebody like Springsteen because he's too big. Bullshit. He's getting no airplay. Yeah, and when you talk about even people, what they don't get elsewhere.
Right.
You have to listen to the other stations. even if it means, God forbid, listening to commercial stations.
Which,
the commercial stations, as pabulum as they are, it's the indicator that says, oh, this is also what's happening.
Yeah. And I do like to do that tuning up and down the dial to see what's going on the commercial radio in our area, as well as other non-commercial stations, because we have a nice variety of that. Within KGNU, I'd say, is more where our controversy is going to be about, do we play Bruce Springsteen or not? I do think, for the most part, our audience is usually happy to hear it. I think that we have plenty of DJs involved at KGNU who say, no, I'm not going to play them, because they are the people that are going to give it the automatic, nah, I can't play that, which obviously puts me in an interesting position as music director when I'm trying to make those decisions. Is it worth KGNU playing that and having, you know, the radical DJ saying, oh God, I can't believe EC's playing that song.
But
when
it's a knee-jerk reaction, isn't it?
I think it is a knee-jerk. And I think it's worth looking at these variety of...
Is that a knee-jerk reaction or a weakness reaction? And yesterday I'm on a roll here.
Sure.
No, it's not that I like Bruce Springsteen. I like Todd Rundgren better, but don't get me started. Okay.
How far is Todd's house?
Todd's living in Hawaii now.
Oh.
That's pretty far.
Yeah, pretty far. But Bearsville.
He used to be from around.
I know. We were almost going to stay at Bearsville Studios yet, but that's another issue. The thing here is that this issue about elitism versus being listener-centric. I used this term yesterday in another group. And this isn't from people here, this group, but this is after a couple conferences, both in terms of public radio and folk. There is an elitism that grows with some of our legend people who are legends in their own minds on staff that, and I've been a program director, so I can say that. But the point is that there's an elitism that totally subverts or isolates the listener. You know, it's like in the folk DJ list, we had this long string on the issue of playing major labels or not. And, you know, the listener doesn't give a damn what label the artist is on. It just does the listener like the artist. So, and how many folk performers Judy Collins, well, maybe not now. The point is that Judy Collins was on some pretty major labels. Do you play Judy Collins enough because she's on a major label? You know, I'm sorry, I will stop there, but there's this, I keep seeing this elitism in fellow DJs that the listener doesn't give a damn who you think you are.
I think, to me, you raised some good issues about this perceived elitism, and I tend to hearken back to, I heard David Brower speak one time about the whole environmental movement, and he was making comments, say, about Earth First, and said, it's really great that we have the groups like Earth First out there, you know, talking about their mission, their interest, and pulling the whole environmental movement to the left even further, so it makes other groups look more mainstream. I think it's vital to have those programmers on the air that are going to be radical, be elitist, whatever you want to call it, that are pulling everything a little more to the left, a little more off-center. When I look at the situation for KGNU, I say, we're really lucky. For one, we've been doing pretty much what we do for 24 years. And it's so scary that, you know, the local commercial stations are still considered to be really good as commercial radio stations go. They're a little more adventurous than what you see in many of the other markets. One of our commercial radio stations has tried to stay with modern sounds. You will hear some hip-hop, you will hear electronica with a lot of rock and roll, obviously. And it seems like we've really pulled everything in our listener area off-center a little bit more. And it helps KGNU to keep everything pulling a little more out of balance. So I'm happy that we'll have some programmers that won't play the major labels, that aren't going to hit major artists, and are just going to keep pushing for newer, more exciting, different things. I do sense out of these same programmers, though, that we have this well, everything should be the most cutting-edge music, and then they're trying to say, well, you know, our morning show is really boring because they're playing folk country bluegrass. I think it's really important to keep that audience happy as well. And I know it's dividing our audience to a certain extent, because I've gone off to conferences about programming, AAA radio, and I get to go home and have all these people in my backyard next weekend. And to me, I just want to keep telling these people, no, make sure you're playing some free-form programming where you're not putting yourself into these little boundaries of it has to fit into AAA, because what happens when the next big sound, a new sound...
What is AAA?
Oh, I'm sorry. AAA is what?
Adult album acoustic alternative.
It's just another label, and it's very Americana heavy at the moment, especially. You know, in Boulder, it's curious because the people at KBCO, their commercial station, love to say, we invented this, and that is why Boulder hosts a AAA conference next weekend. I just, like you say, I think it's limiting the audience to certain styles, and where does a group like Saint-Germain fit into that? And they think they're radical if they're playing Medeski, Martin, and Wood, whom I think of as kind of a mainstream group. I mean, they're great, they're talented musicians, but, you know, to me it's not a question, do you play that or not? You know, are they going to play Buckethead? I mean, let's go for some of the crunchy, weird, fun stuff that's out there, and it works, I think, for us and our audience.
I wasn't critiquing your approach or anything at KGMU. I was just saying that.
No, I think you've raised some good.
The knee-jerk reaction comment that she was saying, that from a lot of DJs all over the country about.
Yeah.
Well,
you have some hands in the back here, and in the green shirt.
A couple of observations on these subjects. My name is Bob Weiser. I'm at WOMR in Provincetown at Cape Cod, which is a community station, also WPRS in Waltham, Mass., which is a college station. And so I sort of see these two worlds and where they intersect and where they don't. And at both stations, you know, we have a huge variety of programming. And, you know, I think like all the stations here, you know, we don't have any paid DJs at either place. We have the majority students at the college station, although there's probably 25% of them are community programmers like myself. And at OMR, we're, you know, it's all community people. We have opera. I think may have had the only show in the known universe of marching band music. The guy who was up, you know, 20 years ago, first one on the air at OMR, the first guy who did the first show on the air did marching band music and had that show up until about 6 months ago when he passed away. You know, the variety of what we do there is extraordinary. And part of the reason I wanted to say something is because all of these questions are so subjective. There are probably five of us who have what you would call folk acoustic shows. But every one of those shows is thoroughly different. And I'm the new guy on the block in that area. You know, I've done folk acoustic programming for years at this other station, but I just came on board at OMR in the last 6 months. And in order to distinguish my show from my colleagues, you know, I play more traditional music on my show, because even though other people play a little traditional folk stuff on their shows, they don't play very much of it. And I have a huge collection of vinyl, so I include more of that in this show because that makes my show unique in that setting. And that's, I think, part of the point I want to make is that every individual programmer, you know, brings their own biases, their own expertise, their own mindset. Change over time. What they're interested in at any given time might be different from another time. If one of the other programmers who plays contemporary songwriters were to leave the station, I might, you know, change what I do at OMR somewhat and play more of those contemporary songwriters, because, you know, I love the traditional music, but I don't think the audience is quite as interested in that. But I'm not sure. I'm still finding that out. There's so much. in music programming, the range of what's possible is so enormous that I think the issue in programming is to encourage people to grow themselves
yep.
and to share what they learn and share their curiosity with their audience. And if you can encourage your programmers to be growing in their own musical interests, that's going to affect your listenership. It's going to raise the level of your audience. And I don't think it's a question of do you play Bruce Springsteen or Bob. I mean, let's face it, Bob Dylan puts out a new album. Who plays it? Where is it on the radio now? It's probably more on our stations than anywhere else. You know, even though he's on a big label, and even though he's going to sell a million copies of that recording, nobody's playing it on the radio except us. So what does that tell us about our role, both as it, both our artistic role and our, role in the marketplace? The labels know perfectly well that they're making money and selling music by artists who don't get played on commercial radio, that only get played on our stations, if they get played at all. And so the question of do we play Bruce Springsteen's new material, which is somewhat different creatively than some of his older material, or not, I think that's a matter of personal taste with the DJ. If you're a Bruce Springsteen fan, you think your audience will want to hear Bruce Springsteen's adventures in world music, well, play it. You know, whatever interests you, if you're interested and you're passionate about it, your audience will get interested and passionate about it. And if you don't have an audience, that's a whole other issue, which is not necessarily the one for this discussion, but it's certainly one to think about.
Why isn't it an issue for this discussion? One builds an audience.
Well, how does one know? I mean, for instance, the woman's question earlier about the 20th century classical.
Yeah.
I thought she was asking, do you think people in Fort Collins will listen to it?
Well,
the 20th century classical artists would want to be interested.
I understand that, and that's a question that we certainly asked ourselves here, and to this day I can't tell you how many people listen to the program that I broadcast, for example, although I find out that there's a considerable number who over the years have picked it up and have listened to the things that I have to say. I think part of what happens is if the only thing you're doing on a music program, and I'm beginning to understand that I'm a fish out of water, I don't belong on this up here at all. I should not be here. But if the only thing you're doing is saying, and the next cut we're going to play is by Bruce Springsteen, if you try to do that with 20th and 21st century classical music, nobody's going to ever listen to you. You've got to have at least 45 seconds of some kind of pithy, intelligent introduction that works so that people know what the context is. You've got to contextualize it for them, and they will listen. When I played the Terry Riley interview the other day, I followed it up by one of the versions of In C, which was a 45-minute version as opposed to a 9-hour version. And I had somebody come up to me afterwards, a good friend, who said, I loved your interview, and he said, and I tried very, very, very hard to listen to In C, but it made me crazy, and I had to turn it off. And the point was, that's fine. The point was, he would never have listened to any of this part before, and maybe in 6 months, if he listens a little bit, maybe he'll grow to like this somewhat. Maybe he won't. I don't know. But if the only thing that you're doing is just simply playing music and saying, this is by so-and-so, he did this in such and such a time, then I don't see how this is any different from anything I can pick up on AM. And I didn't answer Joanne's question the way I should have before, and I thought about it later, and I do have an answer for that. One of the things that I do here is to milk the area. There are more composers and performers in this area of Sullivan County than I can deal with, and it is totally wonderful. I interview them, I play their music, I give, and really, that's the way, that's the entree here. You don't have to go to Amherst, Massachusetts, to interview Lou Spratlin or whatever. You can find it right in your community, and you're doing a lot of wonderful things when you do that.
We have a very rich local musician community where we live, but it's not 20th century class.
Well, but there must be composers who live where you live.
I have a very good friend.
And those are the people.
A 20th century musician composer.
And what happens? What happens when you do this, if you've got, and I understand what EC was saying before about not boxing yourself into genre labels and so forth and so on, and to a certain extent, of course, I think that's plausible. People say, what's 20th century or 21st century classical music? And my answer is, I'm the DJ, I decide. So, I hate the word crossover because it's such a silly word, but one of the wonderful things about about music that is being produced right now is that it doesn't easily fit into little boxes so that you can do things with it. But the other point that I'll make, and then I'll shut up, is that when you get involved in the music scene, I don't care whether it's 20th century classical music or whatever it is, and you start becoming a place that interviews these people occasionally, you begin to get into the wider range of what's going on out there in music, and you become connected to other people and to groups and so forth and so on. And it becomes absolutely, it's a wonderful situation because it's good for the station, it's good for the radio program, and it's good for you. I must say that I don't understand the politics of all of this. Obviously, to some extent, people program music in ways that politicize it. This is all right and this isn't. This is left and this is right. And that that bothers me because my concept of what I do on my program is I play music that I think is interesting. I may not even like it, but I think it's interesting and it should be out there. And I hope that my listeners will have the patience to say, hey, that's something new. That's something I want to hear. I don't, the politicization of whatever the word is makes me crazy.
I never play anything I don't like.
I do not allow my personal taste to get in my way because I don't know what's right. I don't know what's good and what isn't. Well, I have a great tolerance for almost everything.
I wanted to address this issue of the politicization of your music programming, especially in regards to the discussion that was happening earlier about, you know, the major labels, are you going to play them or not as, you know, an independent programmer. I'm from WBKR in Poughkeepsie, where primarily a music oriented, and we pride ourselves on being, you know, very fiercely independent, and we have all sorts of programming, and we have, you know, world music, we do have one 20th century classical program, but most of our music focuses on new independent, like rock based music, and like hip hop and electronic stuff. And we've spent a lot of time discussing this issue recently because I think it's become even more important, or maybe it's just become crystallized around the debates about webcasting now. This is one time where we're suddenly realizing that there is a huge difference between music that's released by independent companies that have an interest in releasing music and by major labels that have an interest in making money. And if the music is there and the music is good, then that's, you know, an added bonus. So the new Bruce Springsteen album is good, and Columbia Records sent us a copy, but we're never going to play it on our station. Because we're kind of realizing that not only very directly for the first time, we have to start paying record companies that are demanding it, you know, for playing their music on the air. But basically, we're trying to establish some sort of moral high ground where we're saying we don't want to have any business dealing with people that are not interested in the music, that are interested in making money. And so I really think that there is a very big difference. And it's a tricky question because, I mean, when this whole webcasting thing happened, I mean, we originally took our station offline on our websites because we thought it was, you know, it's going to be too much of a hassle, too much money, blah, blah, blah. But when you realize that if you can prove that your station plays programming that's, I think, 75% or more, that's not represented by the major publishing companies or not represented by the major labels, and you don't have to pay these webcasting fees, you know, then it becomes a, you know, something that it makes a lot more sense than when it's just a theoretical thing, like we want to deal with major labels or not. It's like a very real thing for your station and for your programmers. And it's tough because a program like mine, where it's extremely freeform, and I try and play as much like new rock-oriented music as I can, but I also play a lot of jazz, and I play a lot of blues, and I play a lot of, you know, folk and country and stuff like this. It's like,
you know, so do you not play the new Sonic Youth?
I don't really like the new Sonic Youth record, quite honestly. But I don't really like it.
Are they on a major label?
Yeah, they are.
I mean, and that's the thing, is you do have major labels that seem like they're morally decent, like Dave Geffen, you think, maybe an okay guy. I mean, he put out Nirvana records, and he let Nirvana tour with Bikini Kill and stuff like this. And this is all stuff that seems like it's very decent. But when it comes down to it, it's a money-making enterprise, you know? And it's like, why play the new Sonic Youth record when you can play the new Fugazi record, which is much better, and here's, like, a man in a company that is about as, you know, morally untouchable as you can get. I mean, there's all sorts of other options out there, is what I'm saying.
And I do agree with that. I think it's really difficult, though, to say we're going to base our programming on this. Have you ever gone to the Boycott RIAA site? Because I was blown away when I looked at the list. You know, I think of RICO and Rounder as the, oh, these are, you know, college non-commercial radio friendly labels, and they're members of RIAA. So, you know, am I going to say we're going to always program against this? No. I mean, KGNU is in the fortunate situation where we are CPB funded, therefore we're taken care of. I do want to take a moral stance, and I'm pretty tempted to go home and have a very blatant, you know, anti-RIAA day, because we want to have people aware of this issue, because I think it's a ridiculous way for us to have to do our programming. We're just not going to play it because of this stance, which is very much driven by the five major record companies.
The gentleman in the back there with the sunglasses had his hand up.
A few quick things. I heard Bruce Springsteen on the way up on classic rock from Philadelphia and a station from Allentown, Scranton. I'm not sure which one. Driving up here from Quakertown, Pennsylvania. And all labels want to make money. And I don't know any label that goes, hey, let's lose money or let's do this and so we can always run in the red, which won't last long. If you read a book called Confessions of a Record Producer, Moses Avalon, the author, lists the five major labels. And underneath those labels are a lot of labels that you might think are independent but aren't. They're hooked into the majors in one way or another, depending on what deal they have. So a lot of the majors don't make much money either. You might think, but when the books are there, there's people who paid a lot of money, but they're also not making a lot of money. It's a tough business.
Yeah, it is a tough business, and my understanding, I haven't read that book, but
great book.
I've heard that, you know, it takes those Britney Spears and the people that do sell a lot of records to kind of bankroll a lot of the other artists.
I have to add something too. I'm always very, very nervous about mission statements that say we take the high moral ground, because often what that really means is we take the high moralistic ground, and that bothers me a great deal. I don't know what the high moral ground means here, especially in terms of what you've just said. This gentleman.
Getting back to what this gentleman said back here, you know, we could sit here and debate all of this, but in terms of the whole concept of what we do, what I do, and he's right, because growing is really important on an individual basis. I've been doing what I do for 11 years, and I've gone back and listened to some of those early shows, which were great to me, but I'm not there anymore. I'm in a different place. My spiritual side has grown in 10 years. You can hear that in the music, and I kind of look at it as a soundtrack that we're painting, you know, the picture. David Wilcox did a song called Leave It Like It Is. You know, wherever the paint falls, it's art. And, you know, I look at that now in all the discussions that we're having, and it's kind of interesting, because whether it's Bruce Springsteen, it doesn't matter to me. If I need that piece to create that soundtrack that will not only help me get through something, but help my audience get through it, we all go through this together every single week. I refer to it sometimes as our 3 hours of therapy. And the music can speak so well through us if we know how to use it and if we remove the boundaries. So whether Bruce Springsteen is on a major label, I don't care. But if it's going to help somebody that's still trying to get over the September 11th tragedy because they lost somebody, then I'll play it. So, I mean, I think that, you know, we have the creativity that the commercial industry doesn't have, but yet we're creating these boxes ourselves, and we're the ones that are creating them internally. We should be blessed that it's not coming from the external, where we can't do anything about it.
Right.
And I think that if we all had the mindset of saying, well, if we need to grab from wherever we need to in the universe to make this a really wonderful thing that we do, that we bring to our audience every single week, that's what's going to make them come back. It may not be the song, it may not be the artist, it might just be the fact that the whole aura of what you do draws them back to you every week. And that's how I've looked at
it. You're here. You're here. You've got to have heart. You've got to have heart.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. We've been going through the discussion of how do you program shows, where do you come from, and that issue of the blank canvas that you've filled up during your show has come up a lot.
But if the only if you start out, it seems to me, by saying that you're going to direct what you're doing at the audience's tastes as they are right then I don't know that we're doing anything else. Anything that's any different from anything that commercial radio is. If we, on some level, if what distinguishes us from commercial radio is not that we are introducing an audience to things that they have not thought about before and not heard before and not considered before, if we're not doing that, then I don't see what our purpose is, finally. You said something interesting to me before, Joanne. You said that you don't play stuff that you don't like. At some point in my teaching career, I discovered that I can enjoy things that I don't like, and it was one of these wonderful blazing moments, and I try to communicate that to my kids, and I'm willing to take the brickbats. How can you possibly enjoy something you don't like? It's a possibility, and that's what allows me to play things that I try not to get my ego involved in what I'm doing there.
I think I like the idea of the mission statement to play that which is not on the other stations, whether I like it or not. I don't like hip-hop, but my station plays it because there's a lot of hip-hop that doesn't talk about hoes and bitches. And that's it's just missing from the commercial hip-hop stations. That's so great, let's play those ones. Or the other side of Led Zeppelin even, they never play. But the question then becomes, okay, I think, and my experience in radio has been that it actually helps the listener, and I know that this can be debated both ways, but we decided that it helps the listener to explore new genres if they know what to expect. In other words, it's not total freeform. It's this block is this thing we call electronica. This block is this thing we call folk. And there's some folk that has kind of a sub-beat that kind of sounds electronic. You know, there's some crossover, to use a word. But in the main, you can generally kind of, you know, like 80% of songs will generally kind of fall into some kind of box. So then the question becomes, all right, we've decided to box our stuff in because we think it helps the listeners. You know, I want to explore. I feel like listening to folk today, and I know it's on at so-and-so time, so I know that's when to go listen. And I won't be bombarded with something I'm just not ready for right now. Now, the question is, when do I put what genres on? Like you said about ghettoizing. Well, somebody's going to get ghettoized. Because you got 24 hours in a day, and most people are asleep at like 10 or 11 o'clock at night, or, you know, they're out partying. Certain people are out partying on Saturday, and certain other people. Like, I'm always upset that science fiction is always left to Saturday night. I'd like to go out and hang out, but I also want to see the science fiction, and I'm out of blank videotapes.
Mm-hmm. See, I think actually you're making a good point for why to do freeform programming, so that you are exposing people to the different thing. In Colorado, you know, we say that our weather forecast is, if you don't like it, just wait 5 minutes, it'll change. We use that same philosophy with the programming, so that we could throw some hip-hop in the afternoon without just hitting people over the head with it. Because I think if you don't like hip-hop and you tune into the station on Sunday night when we're playing hip-hop, you're going to leave. But if you're hearing it in the afternoon, you know, okay, I'm going to hear one song. And we hope that the programmer will give an idea of, hey, look, this is a new piece by Public Enemy. It's very political and conscious. I think they have a strong message that's worth hearing. Maybe they'll stick with it, knowing that you're not going to just be stuck in the hip-hop zone. I think it is difficult trying to make those decisions of how and when you do things, and, you know, sometimes we fall into the convenience of we have this time slot available, we think it'll fit. Different program or different stations I've run into have different styles of how and why they program what they do. At WORT, we talked about it at Grassroots last year, and she got a strip in an evening so that it went from like metal to thrash or something throughout, say, the Monday evening, where, you know, KG Newsmore and across the board at 7 p.m. on weeknights, you're going to have specialty programming. It's certainly nice, I think, if you have some kind of flow. When we first put on an international show that came after our hip-hop show, it was kind of an, oh, God, how are we going to make this work? And it's only in the last few years, I think, it's been an easy transition from one show to the next because we're getting more and more French hip-hop, and you can do things that help you ease that transition. So, you know, it takes me a half an hour to get to gamelan music after a hip-hop show, maybe, but we can get there.
Jason?
I just want to go back to what this guy was saying about growing it. Because I like that I don't think you were saying that, you know, doing something for whatever wherever your audience happens to be, because we never have a way of judging that, but like allowing yourself to grow and then letting people grow with you. But coming back to kind of what this undercurrent debate is, you know, then that for me brings up the question that I know we've talked about at our station sometimes, that it seems like, you know, really young people, like teenagers, don't have sometimes the same life experience or experience with music that allows them to come out and just do like this alternative show or a freeform show. I mean, we've got these young girls that come on and do one night out of a month, and they play what, you know, 16, 17 year old high school kids are listening to, and they'll play Led Zeppelin, and they'll play, I don't know, Ricky Martin or something like that when he was around. And it's like, it kind of makes my skin crawl, but, you know, then sometimes I just try to step back and think, like, how else are they going to get the chance to come on the radio and then grow as people and find different things if they're not there? And I look at it the same way for whatever I try to do, is I can't do anything thinking about what are people going to think when I play it in the audience. You know, the thought's always there, but if I base my decisions of what to play on that idea, I'm constantly thinking, like, you know, this, oh, well, what would indie people think? And I've never even thought about, like, what would indie people think because of what label the artist I happen to be on is playing. You know, I think it's enough if I've got kids listening to me that are listening to, you know, System of a Down or even worse, like, I don't know, all these new metal bands that are on MTV and they're all over the place. And like, if I can get them somewhere by playing, I can play System of a Down, I can play Sonic Youth, and then I can play something that like nobody's even heard of. And they're like, where the hell did you get this? And it's I'm playing it because it's stuff that I like, but, you know, somewhere in there it gives them a chance to hear, wow, you can just play anything.
And at some point, Jason, it seems to me that if the thing that's motivating you is what will my audience like, the next step is to have a call-in show where they tell you what you're going to play and then you lose control of it entirely.
Right, yeah, that's
the gentleman.
Wait a second. No. That so describes my show, because
yours is a
I have,
show.
Okay.
Go ahead. No. So.
Well, my relationship with my audience has become very symbiotic, and I've started out playing only the music that I truly love, and they have completely embraced me, and my show does fit into quite a box and a small kind of a segment. But in defense of stating labels and things, granted my thing is all history, but I talk about labels because particularly in soul music, Stax and Volt and Chess and Motown, you know, that's everything. It really describes the whole music. And again, I think it gives people an education a little bit about the music, and I try to draw people in that way that may not know more than just, oh my God, that's another R&B song or something. So, I think that's really important for my particular thing.
I want people to call my show.
I want people to call my show too. I don't want them to tell me what to play. But and your show is specifically, it seems to be geared for that, and that's the way that it should be. The gentleman with the beard back there has been raising his hand patiently.
Okay, I guess I was kind of in a fairly unique position of having been in the ground floor adding community radio to a vocational school radio station that's been around a bunch of years that basically went off the air when the students left. And what we kind of did to balance this is we've got a bunch of programming that we do. We particularly program in the middle of the night because nobody else seems to want that time slot. And so we've got like about 5 or 6 hours of what I would consider purely free form, where we'll play anything, and we'll play weird stuff back to back that nobody would play. And then at the same time, we do have more, a couple of shows that are specific. For example, we've got one called 20th Century Folk, and the emphasis tends to be a little bit more on protest music, which is pretty much not heard anywhere, and a lot of the stuff from the 40s through the 70s. And, you know, we did that with, and we don't play as much of a country-oriented folk as a lot of other shows do to differentiate ours from that, you know, from the more common genre these days. So, you know, you kind of do what works for your audience and what you kind of like to do. I think that's what, and we also pay a lot of attention to our audience and let them help in requesting things a lot of times. We use the internet relay chat, and we've always got like 20 or 30 people in there. Even when we're not on the air, it's a place for people to gather. They're there every night of the week when we're not. So that's kind of an interesting, you know, thing that some people could pick up on if they haven't tried adding, you know, internet and interactivity to their show. It's kind of fun because a lot of people don't write letters anymore.
Hey, and you know what? I just want to say one thing on that, because clearly the art of letter writing is in my show every week. And as far as being interactive, I forgot to say one thing before about my soul cereal, is at one point I decided to invite any of the listeners to be part of the cereal, and they have now written into me, and I've sent these, I call them personal profiles, along to the guy who writes the story. And so now we have listeners from different, well, unfortunately, it's only from different correctional facilities at the moment, but they're part of our story. So again, it's another way that we've become interactive.
And it is important to have an interactivity, because that is what we're about with community radio. It's just so very hard to participate in your commercial radio station, obviously.
The gentleman in the black T-shirt.
Yeah, a couple things. One, my name is Todd Tyson. I do programming at WBUD in Newark, Delaware, and I've done a few other things in radio. Mostly folk, acoustic, traditional, but very wide definition. And when doing research, and I don't have the time to do as much research as a lot of other folk DJs, I'm on that listserv, and when I hear about people getting prepared for shows, I'm bowled over by the amount of time and academic knowledge and books they've read. And, you know, I wish I could do that, but right now I don't. I paint houses, so I'm on the ladder. But I get to listen to music a lot, too, from my community station. But I also look at other people's playlists. I read the trades that sing out 30 minutes. I don't buy a lot of music. I don't have the funding for that. I receive things in the mail, but I also, getting back to the points about what should one play in a certain market or not, or what your listeners would like, I live outside of Philadelphia. WXPN is the 800-pound gorilla of AAA radio that has a significant folk program that Gene Shea hosts. Excellent show. I always look at his playlist, not because I look for inspiration as to what to maybe play on my show, but to, in a sense, counter program. Gene is fairly mainstream in his taste, has a lot of history, has a lot of interviews, gets people on live, does the kind of show that really no one without that type of clout could do. But he's not covering a lot of up-and-coming folk and traditional artists, because, in a sense, he doesn't have the time. And he doesn't have the curious listenership that's asking for, you know, Pete Bog Fairies doing, you know, contemporary Celtic music out of Scotland. Right. He doesn't know who they are yet, and why would he? He doesn't have the time to check that out. While our listenership, they want to hear stuff like that. I like it, and I think we all hope, well, a lot of us will play music that we previewed and really like, even though no one else heard about it or everyone else has heard about it. But I'm not going to play a whole lot of Tom Rush. I love Tom Rush. But people are hearing that because most of our listeners probably are listening to Gene or listening to some other programs where they're going to hear a John Gorka. Now, that's not to say I will never play them, but I'm more likely to play some of the lesser-known artists. As far as politics, from the standpoint of current events and a lot of what he was saying about the history of social activism in folk music in particular, you don't hear that a whole lot. And so I do keep up with current events pretty well. So that there are a lot of issues happening, whether it's globalization or whether it's suburban sprawl, which in my area is a major issue, that, hey, there's a lot of music out there that addresses those issues, that you can build a whole set, maybe even a whole show, but certainly 45 minutes of music around a topical issue, and you can give a context to it, to your local area. And yes, you may sound like you're on your soapbox and you shouldn't be on there for more than 30 or 40 seconds. But I think listeners really appreciate that, bringing it all home to your local area with what programming and issues outside of the music as well. Yeah.
The gentleman with the glasses?
As a non-radio person, what I do is when I'm driving around,
turn a dial on it, and I listen to the music that catches me emotionally and captures my imagination. And I usually go for good vocals and a strong beat. But I'm not hooked on any one radio station because there's so much good music out there, whether it's country or rock and roll or college or whatever. So I'm across the dial listening until I go, hey, I'm hooked. I'll listen to this for a while. That's just the way I like to listen.
To get back to what Jason was talking about before, it made me think of a thing that happened several years ago. I finished playing a set of music, and we're talking about the growth issue. How can you, letting your audience hear new things, letting them grow in different. I had just finished a set of music, and I got a phone call, and this girl said to me, "Who was that person that you played in three songs back?" And I kind of looked, and I said, "You mean the song from Joni Mitchell?" She said to me, "Is she new?"
she's new to her.
Yeah.
And then that's when I said, okay, and those are the things that, in terms of growth, in terms of
absolutely
bringing your audience in.
And not to have expectations about where they are.
Right, and also not, and as a programmer, not to label. Because when you label, that may not have happened the way that it did.
The young lady there?
Two things. One, in terms of talking between songs, I have actually had people call me and tell me to talk less. So, but then, of course, I complain on the air that somebody called and insulted me, and then I'll have, a few people call and say, no, we like you talking. So it's kind of hard to tell, which is okay, but I have hypercritical listeners, obviously. And then the other thing, I'm from WRPI, up in Troy, New York, and actually, the other thing is, we haven't talked about this, and I don't know if this is a forum or not, but I'm wondering if you guys have any sort of internal conflict between news and music. Because that's actually something that was brought up in one of the sessions yesterday, and it was a news type session. It was,
yeah, so was I was there.
Yeah, and she basically said, "Who needs music? You should all have news." And
Music is censorship.
And news isn't?
Sometimes used as censorship. I mean, I don't want to have panels like
that. That's not what she
meant. Must be a different session, but it was just.
That sounds like a good lunch topic or something.
I've been acting program director for a while, assistant for all of our econ executive producers positions have to be students, but we've had a bunch of slacker students, and basically I was the only one who raised my hand and said, "Listen, I'm taking over," and I would take over when students slacked, and now with another student who's program director who's leaving the school, so again, I'm going to take over, and basically we sit down and make the schedule, and there's a conflict that, how much time we give to news shows, and continually, like Steve Pierce is one of our news people, and he's here today, and he comes in and says, we like these blocks and this and this and this, and we'll be like, we like music, and I've been very, very pro music all along, but the thing is, I'm sort of realizing, we do serve an important public service in terms of providing news, and it's so hard, it's only 24 hours in a day, and most people really don't want a 4 a.m. show, we just go off the air at like 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
I just can't fit it all in.
I'm sure that's an issue that's not alien to a lot of our stations because I was talking about the difference in the music audiences that we're serving, and yeah, then there's the difference in having the music and the news audience, and there is, I bet, no one absolute answer other than our big public radio station in Denver area finally have been buying up AM stations so that they can do that dream that I think many of us have is on their FM dial, their classical music all the time, on the AM dial, their news all the time. So yeah, they're able to provide both services.
You have to have the money to support that.
Yeah, we've talked about, wouldn't that be a great dream for us.
I want to get just for one second, I just want to get back to the first thing that you said, and it occurs to me that the amount of talking that you do between cuts, I remember maybe the second show I ever did, I got a phone call from a woman who said, "Look, if I wanted to take a course in musicology, I'd go to a college." And it was one of the best phone calls I ever got. But there is a difference, I think, in how much you can say if you're doing a music show where your cuts are 2.5 minutes long, as opposed to a music show where you're maybe going to play 5 pieces in 2 hours. So, in other words, if you're playing a piece that's 2.5 minutes long or 1.5, you really do have to limit yourself, it seems to me, to what you're saying. Whereas if you're doing something that's going to be 20 minutes long, followed by something that's 14 minutes long, you can indulge a little bit of context there. It should never be more than 1.5 minutes or 2 minutes, but you can still say some more things, it seems to me. And that's what I've tried to do with my program. Yeah. This gentleman.
Gene Moore from William Catholic Tampa. And in response to your question, talking too much, I think it's important to set up the song, because by setting up the song, you bring some enticement to the music. Our program director, Randy Wynn, is a master of this. I've been in Tampa for about since 94, and as listening to the station before I came on staff, he can make you cry with some of the setup he does for a song. He did a setup of a Stan Rogers song, Song for the Candle, which is a very song. Stan Rogers died a tragic death. He died in a plane that caught on fire on the runway. And he set up this song, and it was so beautiful. So how he set it up, you could cry, and I know the phones were ringing off the hook. That's important, to set up the song, to bring some emotional content to your listener, to make it feel like it is very special.
And maybe some intellectual content, too.
Most of our programmers, we have very good programmers. They do good setup, they do good research. Our R&B show that we do on Wednesday afternoon, he does great research on what he's playing. We have a jazz job and swing show on Wednesday nights. Pat Chambers has been in radio since 1947. And he takes anecdotes from things that are happening, people who have died recently, plays a lot of that stuff. He knows the music, and it's very special. It makes it special to the audience. He's sharing his love of the music to the audience, and it makes it unique. And I think that's what we do in community radio that makes it very special.
And, of course, everybody's approach, I think, can be a little different. We have our Friday afternoon show. You're lucky if you hear them back announce their music. It's a husband and wife that do it. One of the more recent phone calls they got was, she needs to get rid of him. He's insulting her all the time. He's interrupting her. Because they babble. They're funny. And, for me, it's always that I've got to keep the check on it, mostly in that very many of our female DJs come and go, we want to be like Kathy is on Friday afternoon. Obviously, we can't be overrun by women trying to just babble and be funny, because it would take the station down, I think. But to have one show where they're just going off and getting crazy, it works. It works for us. So.
And I want to bring up something about your question about some news and music. It's always hard to do that. But we found unique ways to do that. And one of the things is we try to expose people to different music on news shows. Really good thing, we have a Black Public Affairs shows on Friday afternoon at 1 o'clock. And Mabili, the host of the show, is really into hip-hop. He's really working with socially conscious hip-hop. And what he does is that the daytime people don't hear this, and they don't know what it's all about. So what he did is he brought in some guys that are local hip-hop people, plus our own hip-hop hosts, and he talked about socially conscious hip-hop. We got more response from that one show that he did than any other show we've done in a long time. And we're continuing to do that on a regular basis. So I think the idea is you talk about revolution or activism in music, is to bring that activism in music to your public affairs. Because it's there. There are people who are very politically conscious and socially active that are musicians. Yeah. And we need to bring that to our show.
Not to mention pointing out to the public affairs people that there's a lot of politics and activism,
yes,
within music. And when we are playing music that just isn't heard other places, I think it really is part of the foundation and goal of our stations.
Of course, and we're kind of speaking at Converge here because we got the music program people here and all the news people are now at the tent.
Mm-hmm.
But if the people that feel strongly about the news programming and get to a point where there is that type of conflict, I would point out to them, this is why I want to have a discussion like this going on, is that if your idea of having news is because you want to have an informed and empowered citizen for democracy, or you want people to know about what's going on in the world so they can do something about what's going on with their lives,
then one of the things that you have to present to people is that we have a very fractured culture in America. It's from a clash of different cultures, but just what our lives have become. And it's important to have the music programming there, not just for its political content, but just to bring up what is our culture? What is it that holds people together? What is other ways for people to communicate? And that to me is like, if you just had news without any other opportunity. And I also want to go back to the thing about speaking in between songs. That's another thing is like, that happened with the FM, the homogenization of FM. In the early days of FM radio, you'd have people like, I don't know, like Gene Shepherd or something do all night talking. But you'd also have the real freeform DJs where they would talk a lot and they would play a lot of music. And everybody's, once you're not saying what you should do because of how to maximize listenership and maximize advertising revenue, all bets are kind of off. My thing is like I play like an 8-song chunk and then I'll talk for 20 minutes. If I'm on, if I'm not interesting, then I'll just keep playing music and I'll let people know what station they're listening to in between it, you know. And I know it would be better if everybody knew what every song was that I was playing, and that would make a stronger show. But now I'm like, you know, I just go by whatever the feeling is on a given night. I'm just throwing it out there.
An interesting thing you said before about the NPR bayou that is buying up all the radio stations. Interesting thing to watch out for is. About a year or 2 years ago, NPR decided that they were going to hire the consultant. And you talk about the homogenization of radio. There's a gentleman in New York who I have a lot of respect for. His name is Jonathan Schwartz. He was on WNEW-FM back in 1967. Still does a radio show there on an AM station. And when I interviewed him several years ago, he referred to the consultant as the consultant bursted on the scene like a massive oil spill. He referred to it. And he said it was like living in France but having someone from Philadelphia coming over and telling you how to speak the language. So when you see that with the AM stations and how they're splitting that, that is the new trend that's being recommended to NPR stations across the country.
And for the great irony, my mom is in, she does public radio in Aspen, and they're trying desperately to keep the scene there thriving, because there's actually two public radio stations in the Roaring Fork Valley, one of which does all classical music with some NPR. So who do they hire at the Denver station but some of her great friends from England to tell them how to program better classical music? And, you know, you've got to be happy that there's that much classical programming out there in this one community.
Yes and no.
What roles may become more enhanced as NPR takes the same route.
It's already taken that route, and an instructive thing to do is to sit down with either a classical radio program such as Performance Today or one of the jazz programs that is produced by NPR and make a list of what they play. You will discover, for example, that Performance Today plays almost nothing but safe 19th and 18th century music and an occasional bow to the 20th century. I made a list of this because I actually gave a talk on this in Rome, and I wanted to point out that the number of cuts in a given day that comes from the 19th century on Performance Today, which they're now going to destroy also, is so much greater than anything they do with 20th or 21st century classical music. And the same is true of almost all the other kinds of music. NPR has, in my opinion, simply become another commercial station. It is the most boring network that there is. And as we drop some of those programs from our own weekly programming, I applaud, because it is just simply, it's the worst kind of programming that there is, as far as I'm concerned. This gentleman with a beard has been patient.
Right. And a thought I had, because people are mentioning this thing, and we've seen a lot of this NPR split thing, we should probably take a little bit of leaf from that and start looking into adding AM stations for community radio. I don't think I've seen anybody do it. It seems like a perfectly sensible idea, especially for news and talk. And the stations are ultimately fairly cheap in most places, especially the smaller markets, where it's harder than heck to get a community station at all. These things are going, you know, actually, basically dying. So it'd be a good idea for people to put together, and if you've got a market where you can get a station, you could probably buy it in a couple of years of fundraising and do, you know, add a bunch of extra programming. So I think that's, you know, something we need to do, especially because the right-wingers have been doing it. They've been brokering all kinds of stations all over the country, and now with the NPR emphasis, I don't know that this is going to be a long-lived trend. We may have to, you know, hurry up and grab some of the stations before they disappear, but there's lots of them available for a few hundred, you know, few hundred thousand or less.
Yeah, we've actually seen some of that in our market where the university wanted to finally get an actual station on the air because what they'd been doing was broadcasting only the dormitories. And what they got was an AM station, and Working Assets had come to our community to do their experiment in running radio, and they were on AM, and that was actually perfect for them because there they were in the midst of other talk radio stations, and finally it was a talk radio that had a different slant than most of what you hear on there. So we'll see. I mean, obviously, that's another discussion about just what are the future trends in the radio world.
Yeah, I'm from WF to Champaign. I'd like to quickly tell a little bit about the talking between music. I do a world music show, so it's kind of unique because most of my music are non-English, so I sometimes try to tell them, you know, what I played. And so one of the songs I played a few weeks ago, it's a Mexican tune, and it said, the translation, that I love you because you smell like an armadillo. When I read it, I felt urged that I need to say that, like, no matter what. Things like that. But when I play like non-English song, like one of the artists I play sometimes, though it's a world music show, but I kind of don't include all the non-English. I play like Buffy Sandberg, she's a folk singer, a lot.
Yeah.
And most of her song has like stories behind it. And I, you know, at least like 1 or 2 minutes, I don't have to talk for half an hour, and I try to share that too. So I think it's a unique idea, as long as you know what you're telling, as long as it's interesting. And I noticed that when I talk more, people call and say like, oh, thanks for letting me know that. And one time this listener called, and she wanted to know that she couldn't, I have accents, she couldn't figure where I was like from. And she was like, oh, are you French? I'm like, I don't know. So things like that, like when I talk, it's like more intimate, like more, like, I enjoy it. So probably like some of the shows that people do, they don't talk. There's one DJ at the station, we call him DJ, he play. So he play and then he just sits there. So, but things like that, so just like part of the show.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, same subjects. It's not how long you talk, it's what you say.
Absolutely.
And it's like everything else we're discussing. You know, some things you can get away with not saying anything. Sometimes that's the best thing to do. I was out working at Winterhawk last weekend. I didn't get to Newport. My partner, who was at Newport, saw Bob Dylan's show. Her report was, he did not say a word to the audience the entire time. You know, I don't know how many folk singers can get away with going on stage for an hour and a half and not saying a word, not attempting to interact with the audience. Bob Dylan, that was what he wanted to do. There's a place for everything. I think the reason for talking when you're doing a folk and acoustic show is because there are threads that tie songs together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you point where the needle needs to go and you play the music, the audience will pull the thread along. But you said, I don't see it as setting up a song. I see it as setting up a set. Now, maybe that's just my personal approach to it. And I think that's the point. You know, there's a lot of different ways to do it, to not just be a human jukebox. We are more than just we're not going into the record library like the computerized things, you know, and randomly selecting songs from whatever collection of CDs happens to be in the computerized jukebox that day. We are human beings. We're programming. What we say is what helps the audience to hear what the song has to offer. We know more about the music, presumably, than the people who are listening, but we can't tell people everything we know. So if we selectively point in a direction, play some songs, you know, the song, if we do it right, the songs speak for themselves, and all we're doing is starting the process up. And so it's really not how much you say. I mean, when you go on and babble like I'm doing now, nobody wants to listen. When you go on the air and you point in the right direction, the music carries it, and that's, to me, that's the way to go.
Hi, I want to follow up with this gentleman who has just been talking about, and talking about a person that worked at WBAI that really loves Bob Dylan and still does it, and still there, and growing up, still doing it, although I haven't heard him do it very often in the recent past. We used to do it a lot more in the olden days when there seemed to be a lot more freedom at that station. And what he did is, it's a very radical approach to playing music. You can talk it all, and the set might last 20 minutes, it might last 45 minutes, it might last an hour and a half, but what he would do before he played anything is he would have an idea in his mind of what he wanted to say, and there were other producers there that did it just as excellently, although I've never heard it done at any other radio station. He would have a poem in his mind. It's almost as if he wrote the poem first, or he had an idea of what he was trying to bring out, and there was all kinds of dialectic involved and all kinds of twists and turns involved. It wasn't just one thing, and it wasn't just one commentary on one thing, but it was very complex. It had a beginning, it had a development, it had a middle, it had an end. But he didn't use words, and he didn't say what he was thinking, but he would pick out songs, and each song expressed one element of this whole complex piece of whatever it was that he was trying to say. And the end result was that the audience felt like they were communicating with each other, even though they were isolated in different houses. And they felt like they were communicating with the music. And they felt, even more importantly, they felt like they were communicating with the artist that was putting together this piece of understanding without having to say a word. And bringing out all the magic of music and all the aspects of what it can do, and using all the familiar songs and all the songs and pretty much anything that had words, and even some types of music that didn't have words, but that's what was called for at that particular time. And these sets would consist of, 12, 14, 16, 20 different songs that totally ended up transcending the individual songs and composing a piece of understanding that there's no other way that could have come across. And I just thought it was a work of genius. Bob Fast did it in a marvelous way. But there are other people working at that station that are ready to do it also. And I just wish I could hear, I mean, different stations doing that kind of artistic.
Joanne, I have a question I want to ask you, and that is, people tend to tune in and tune out of a radio program, whenever they happen to be doing whatever they're doing. What happens in a situation that you've described? I mean, I would love to become proficient enough someday so that I knew enough about the music I broadcast so that I could really do that with aplomb. But people don't listen to entire programs. They come in and, you know, then I guess they just enjoy whatever they're hearing.
I know, I mean, he developed a very strong following. I mean, radio was coming on, people would turn that program on and not fall asleep for 5 hours all night long because the program is going on. And I suppose it's hard in this day and age of soundbite radio, but his program is anything but that. And it just gave him a total gestalt that was like so healing somehow, you know. So comprehensive, and just such a reminder of what real art can be in a way that you just don't hear anymore. And I just wish that, you know, we could bring some of that back.
Right. Yeah, a couple of things that come to mind are talking about ideas to help bring your audience in that we try to do it in the end. We have such a large record library, it's just huge, and we hardly have the space to do it. We're always weeding stuff out. Sometimes DJs will say, well, today we're playing from the top shelf, because the top shelf you can't reach, and we get all the artists from off the top shelf. Or the other day on our Afternoon Blues show, it's Save the CD, this CD is weeded, what do you think? And we get reaction from our listeners, Save the CD. Or we have a dedication to our listeners to try to meet their request. If we have it, if it's the genre of the show, we're going to try to play it. And we have some DJ, some programmers will come in and say, it's your day to program my show. And that brings the audience into them. It's bringing their audience, bringing their attention into the program or into the station, and it brings them closer to us.
How do you program your show?
I don't program. I'm not even on the air. I can speak for some people. Some people will walk in and they'll just pop something in and just let it flow. Some people do segues to other different things. They'll play something in one genre of music and go to another genre of music. It goes from that extreme. You may have sometimes we'll do our afternoon drive time does a lot of all country rockabilly stuff like that. They may do a Bloodshot day, or you may do people that might we do specials on, of course, birthdays and things like that, or people who have passed on, or things like that. It just depends. It's really more open and freeform.
I guess my real question was, do your programmers program the shows in advance? I know that, for example, I have learned over four and a half years that I can get between 92 and 94 minutes worth of music into my program, and I'm constrained by that. And so I can't just walk into the station with 30 CDs and say, I think I'll play this one. I have to know that it's going to fit into the time sequence. So that in some sense is a limiting factor. It's not a bad limiting factor, but it is. I just can't do it off. There are other people, I'm sure, who are wonderful at doing this. They could just say, oh, you know, I'm not.
Talking to our programmers every day and seeing what they do and knowing them very well. Some program, like I said, some programmers can just. I have one. Our afternoon Wednesday afternoon programmer does R&B. He's finally got a real job. He's almost 4 years old. He finally got a job. So he rushes in. He gets a break from work. He rushes in and just throws it in, and he does a fantastic. He's one of our best programmers. Does a great show. We have a young lady who just started doing a morning show, the second half was from 9 to 11, and she's very meticulous. She takes 5, 6, 7 hours to listen to everything, find out what's new, and she meticulously writes stuff down, and then she'll leave some space for requests. Other people, like our jazz, jive, and swing show, he's very meticulous. He has his CDs labeled with comments about what's going on and what that person's doing, who's on, you know, naming the artist on the cuts and things like that, each particular player on the cut. Some people have the, you know, it's just, it's different for everybody. I think there's no set way to do it. You just go in and whatever you feel like that day. And some people are like that, some people are very meticulous and they pick stuff out. I
just wondered how, you know, a lot of this also depends upon the level of familiarity that people have with their own. And I admit right off the bat that since I came to all of this very late, I was an English teacher. I didn't know anything about 20th century classical music, that I'm still learning. I don't have the ability that, for example, we have a jazz programmer, David Dan, who was one of the best I've ever heard anywhere. He knows somehow or other everything there is to know about anybody who ever played with anybody anywhere in the world. And he can play a piece and he can just ad lib off the top of his head. I could never do that in a million years. I'm just not good enough.
Sidebar on this, two different radio stations, two different ways of organizing the record library, that actually affects the way I program on the two stations, and I wonder if it's worth just tossing out the, you know, one station, everything is organized alphabetically by genre, and that allows me a lot more stream of consciousness activity as a programmer. The other station, things basically are organized chronologically. They're given a number when they arrive in the studio. Eventually, they're given a little colored tag that goes on the spine so you know what genre they're in. But other than that, you got to go into the computer or the paper log to identify what artist and where what number is the artist, so you can go into the shelf and pick out the thing. I can't just do the consciousness radio at the station. I have to plan my show more at that station than I do at the other station. You know, I rely on my personal collection much more at the station, which is organized that way. Do other people have any observations on this subject?
I think we've got room for one more comment. Somebody who hasn't spoken want to speak?
Well, our library, we organize by genre. But I get up to the music director all the time and said, Flea, what are you doing? He says, this should go in world, and this should be bluegrass, and this should be this. And it says, you know, well, Sonny Landreth is blues, but you got him in rock, or you got...
It's so hard to always figure out these categories.
You have one CD will be a folk-oriented, and the next one will be a rocker. And
all this. We've got Katie Lang all over our library.
See, we're lucky at our station. We have a station manager who allows us to decide what music belongs in our program, period. Christine has never said to me, that's not modern classical music, why are you playing it? And she wouldn't.
No, it's the same with us. And I think the thing is that you get your programmers involved in how the library is set up, how things are laid out, so they communicate back and forth. That's where we have our programmer meetings, and they talk back about libraries. There's a lot of communications from our music director to the programmers, letting them know, hey, this is new in the library, this is where it's at. We set a whole section out for new people. We have a section for artists that are coming to town for us and then other people. And then we have people who just carouse the library and look for things that are new or old stuff. And it's just, it's open to those people, and they look and they find the stuff. And there's a lot of communication with the program director. And it's, you know, he says, here's something new you might want to listen to. There's some stuff, there's a list up. But it's really, I think the user-friendly thing is to have it by genre, alphabetical order.
Which is what we do, yeah. Okay, last person, you've had your hand up. Go ahead.
We've got a kind of an interesting situation. The station that we program doesn't have a music library whatsoever. We're, of course, also programming from 80 miles away, so it's our collection. And we're finding that we're doing a lot more stuff that we've added to the computer running. We've got about, 400 gigs of material off a hard drive or hard drives. And plus, we're doing lots of stuff off of vinyl, so it's a weird combination. We're slowly trying to convert the stuff to hard drive from vinyl, but it takes a lot of work to do that. So genreing is a lot of it, you know, putting stuff by category, but it makes it much easier once it's on a computer to find 15 songs that talk about fish. I mean, we've done that.
I've done 3 hours of fish.
Make shortcuts from one category to another so a song fits in 10 places.
That would be the trick. Well, I think we have to wrap this up. You've been a really interesting group to talk with and to listen to, and we thank you very much for participating in this and hope that the rest of your stay here will be pleasant and that you've been enjoying yourselves so far. And thanks very, very much on behalf of all of us.
Thanks.